The street is a living thing. It breathes through the bass of a speaker cabinet and the steam of a kitchen window. For our people, migration was never just a flight. It was a gamble. We traded the heat of the sun for the cold weight of the city. We traded the safety of the village for the anonymity of the high rise. By the 1970s, the dream of the return started to sour. The host nations were no longer polite. The welcome mat was pulled back to reveal a floor of jagged glass. In London and New York, our families found themselves caught between two worlds. One world wanted our labor, but hated our skin. The other world was a home that was fading into a memory. This is the history of the friction. This is the story of how we held our ground when the ground tried to move beneath us. Chapter 1. The Concrete Trap. The fog in London does not just sit, it clings. By 1975, the city felt like a pressure cooker with the lid taped shut. The first generation had arrived with suitcases and Sunday best clothes. They believed in the British Empire. They believed the leaflets that promised work and a future. But their children saw something else. The second generation was born into a landscape of grey brick and aggressive policing. They were not guests. They were targets. The economic downturn of the mid-70s hit the migrant communities first and hardest. Factories closed. Overtime vanished. The tension was not just about money. It was about the right to exist in a public space. The front line was the street corner. In neighborhoods like Brixton and Handsworth, the police used the SUS law to stop and search anyone who looked like they did not belong to the authorities. A young man from the islands was a question mark. To the young man, the policeman was an occupying force. This was the birth of a specific kind of Caribbean grit. We realized that the mother country was a myth. It was a cold house with a locked door. We had to build our own walls. We did this with sound. The sound system was more than a party. It was a defensive perimeter. When the heavy bass of a reggae track shook the windows of a council flat, it claimed the air. It told the neighbors and the state that we were here. It created a space where the language of home could be spoken without judgment. But this created its own conflict. The older generation, our parents, were terrified. They had spent decades trying to blend in. They wore the hats and the gloves. They spoke with a quiet precision. They saw their children's rebellion as a threat to the fragile peace they had negotiated. The dinner table became a war zone. The parents preached respectability. The children practiced resistance. By 1979, the political climate shifted from cold to freezing. The rise of far-right groups brought violence to the doorsteps of migrant families. Bricks through windows were common. Arson was a shadow that followed us home. The state did not protect, it observed. We learned quickly that if we wanted a future in this geography, we would have to fight for every inch of the sidewalk. The tension was no longer a domestic dispute, it was a matter of survival. The streets were ready to burn, and the first match was about to be struck. The pressure reached a breaking point during the hot summer of 1981. The Swamp 81 police operation in Brixton was the final insult. Over 900 people were stopped and searched in a single week. The community watched. They waited. Then the sky turned orange. The riots were not just outbursts of anger. They were a demand for recognition. We were no longer migrants waiting for a ship back home. We were a new kind of citizen, forged in the fire of a city that tried to break us. But as the smoke cleared in London, a different kind of pressure was building across the Atlantic. In the borough of Brooklyn, the conflict was not just with the state. It was with the very idea of what it meant to be a success. Would the pursuit of the American dream cost us the soul of the islands? Chapter 2. The Divide of the Dollar. New York City in the 1980s was a different beast. While London felt like a siege, New York felt like a race. Our people settled in Flatbush, Crown Heights, and the Bronx. They did not just want to survive, they wanted to win. The tension here was rooted in the dollar. The migration from the Caribbean to the United States created a massive economic engine. This was the era of the barrel. We filled large plastic drums with rice, flour, clothes, and electronics to ship back to the islands. This was not just charity, it was a lifeline. But the lifeline was also a tether. The remittance economy created a strange and painful divide. Those who stayed on the islands began to see those who left as walking bank accounts. When you returned home for a visit, You could not just be a cousin or a brother. You had to be a provider. You had to wear the gold chains and the designer sneakers to prove the migration was worth it. If you did not look successful, the trip was a failure. This put an immense psychological weight on the diaspora. Many were working three jobs, cleaning offices at 3 in the morning, just to send back enough money to keep the family land in Jamaica or Barbados. Inside the New York enclaves, the culture was being preserved and mutated at the same time. The Caribbean influence on early hip-hop is undeniable. DJ Kool Herc, a Jamaican immigrant, brought the sound system culture to a basement on Sedgwick Avenue in 1973. He used the massive speakers and the toasting style of Jamaican DJs to birth a global movement, but this led to a new conflict. The African-American community and the Caribbean immigrant community often clashed over resources and identity. We were all black in the eyes of the police, but the cultural nuances were a source of friction. We were islanders, or JBs to some. We were foreigners in our own skin. This tension moved from the streets into the homes. The Americanized children of Caribbean parents began to lose the dialect. They traded the patois for the slang of the New York boroughs. To the parents, this was a betrayal. It felt like the islands were being erased one conversation at a time. They feared their children were becoming Yankees, who had no respect for the struggle that brought them there. The house was a museum of the old country, but the world outside was a fast-moving machine that demanded assimilation. By the 1990s, the drug trade added a lethal layer to this tension. The posses from the islands brought a level of violence that shocked the authorities. These were not just street gangs. They were paramilitary organizations with deep roots in Caribbean politics. Their presence in cities like New York and Miami tarnished the reputation of the entire diaspora. The hard-working nurse and the ambitious student were now looked at with suspicion. The state responded with new laws. The gate to the American dream began to narrow. The economic bond between the diaspora and the islands was becoming a golden cage. The islands needed the money, but they feared the influence of the deportee culture coming back from the north. The cycle of migration was producing a generation that belonged nowhere. They were too Caribbean for New York, and too American for the islands. The stage was set for a systemic betrayal. The host nations were preparing to check the receipts on our residency, and the cost was going to be measured in human lives. If the paperwork says you do not exist, where do you go when the police come for you? Chapter 3. The Identity Tax. The new millennium brought a cold technological efficiency to the management of people. In the United Kingdom, the tension of the 80s evolved into a bureaucratic nightmare known as the Hostile Environment Policy. It was designed to make life so difficult for undocumented migrants that they would leave on their own. But the policy did not just hit the newcomers. It took aim at the elders. This was the beginning of the Windrush scandal. People who had lived in Britain for 50 years were suddenly told they were illegal. They were fired from jobs. They were denied health care. They were locked in detention centers. The state had lost their arrival records. In many cases, the government had intentionally destroyed them. This was a direct assault on the legacy of the diaspora. It told an entire generation that their decades of labor, taxes, and community building meant nothing without a specific piece of paper. We saw men and women in their 70s being deported to islands they had not seen since childhood. They arrived in Kingston or Bridgetown with nothing but the clothes on their backs. They were strangers in their birthplace. The islands, struggling with their own economic pressures, could not easily absorb these returnees. In the United States, the climate was equally harsh. The expansion of the deportation machine meant that even minor legal infractions could result in a permanent exile. A man who had lived in Brooklyn for 30 years could find himself on a plane to Port-au-Prince because of a decades-old misdemeanor. The family structure was shattered. Children were left to grow up without fathers or mothers. The remittance stopped. The barrels stopped. The bridge between the two worlds was being burned from both ends. The third generation is now coming of age in this wreckage. They are the grandchildren of the pioneers. They are tech-savvy and globally connected, but they carry the trauma of the hostile environment and the border wall. They are reclaiming their identity through art and activism, but the friction remains. The rise of social media has allowed for a digital Caribbean identity, but it cannot replace the physical safety of a home. The tension is now internal. It is the struggle to define oneself in a world that views migration as a crime rather than a contribution. The islands themselves are changing. They are no longer just passive recipients of the diaspora's money. They are becoming more vocal about the brain drain. They watch as their brightest minds leave for London, New York, and Toronto, only to face the possibility of being discarded when they are no longer useful. The relationship is transactional and fraught with resentment. The history of the Caribbean diaspora is a history of people who are constantly being asked to prove they belong. As we look at the streets of London and New York today, the sound systems are still there, the food is still there. The culture is a dominant force in the global market. But beneath the surface, the pressure is still building. The laws are getting tighter. The rhetoric is getting louder. The history of our migration is not a finished book. It is a live wire. We are a people who have learned to build a home in the heart of the storm. But the storm is getting stronger, and the ground we stand on is still not our own. The debt of the empire is long overdue, but who is left to collect?